Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Well, I think there was 2 points in my life, clearly, when the whole world was taking up this news. First one was when I broke Bobby Fischer's record, becoming the youngest grandmaster at age of 15. And then later on, of course, when I won against Garry Kasparov, it was special for the world, I guess, that suddenly it was clear that it is possible for a woman to beat the world champion.
Dear listeners, before we get to the interview with Judith Polgar, we hear a few words from Dana Reisnietze-Ursola. Dana is a woman grandmaster and an impressive chess personality herself. She speaks in her role as the managing director and deputy chair of the management board of FIDE.
Ladies and gentlemen, chess players, followers, fans, and women supporters, I'm proud to present the latest edition of Women Chess Podcast, co-produced by FIDE and our great supporters Lilith Khan and Michael Busse from Schachgeflüster, who've been working hard on 10 exciting episodes, allowing us to meet great personalities in the chess world, world champions, federation presidents, opinion leaders, arbiters, scientists. And I hope you also had the same experience, the same excitement to learn from them, to get inspired from them, to enjoy their way of thinking and excitement to go about a game. What a journey it has been. These interviews and the whole year for women in chess. Some would think that this is the end, the year is finishing, and the special label is also gone with that. But I can assure you that this is only the beginning. As the Chinese proverb says, the first step is to be made for a long journey. It is the same. The first step has been made for women empowerment, for women's support. And I believe we will have so many great stories ahead, so many great projects ahead, so many great achievements together with you ahead, so that our chess world is the better place for women, is the exciting place for the girls, is the attractive place for future chess professionals, whatever area of occupation that the ladies would choose. Enjoy the episode with one of the greatest chess players in the world, Judith Polgar, who is so special with the fact that she has gained a lot from chess, and now she gives so much back to chess in the chess world and beyond its borders.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the final edition of our FIDE podcast of the Year of Women in Chess. In this podcast, we introduce you to some amazing and inspiring women in the world of chess, including players, authors, coaches, journalists, and chess streamers. The podcast is a collaboration of the Chess Sports Association, the FIDE Women's Commission, and the German podcast Schachgeflüster. Today's episode is actually the last episode of this Year of the Woman in Chess series, but we're going to end big. Our guest is the strongest female chess player of all times. She achieved her Grandmaster title at the age of 15 years and 4 months, thereby breaking the record previously held by former world champion Bobby Fischer. With just 12 years, she broke into the FIDE Top 100 players list. She later made it into the world top 10 and inspired both women and men around the world to take up the game. Nowadays, she's commentating the world's top tournaments and is an ambassador to get more females into chess and use chess in education. We're absolutely honored to welcome Grandmaster Judith Polgar to today's episode. Welcome, Judith. Okay, so Judith, it has become a tradition to ask our guests the first question, where they're from, and to tell us a little bit about their country and the chess culture there.
I'm from Hungary, and I live in the capital, Budapest, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world, I believe. And we have a great chess culture going back for more than a century, as we always had a top 10 world-class player. So this was also inspiring for me.
Perfect. Let's get started a little bit from the very beginning, because you grew up in a very special chess family. So your dad was a psychologist and had this idea that his kids should specialize in one field. Tell us a little bit about the idea and your upbringing.
Well, my father is a teacher, actually, and also my mother. But when he got to meet my mom, then he already had the idea that once he's going to get married, they are going to have 6 children, and the children will not go to school, but they are going to be homeschooled and being specialized on one specific field. And then when I was born, my sister Susan was 7 years old already, and my other sister Sophia a year and a half. So for me, it was at the age of 5, it was kind of natural to start chess as well.
And you just said that all your sisters play chess, and indeed all your sisters actually turn out as incredibly strong chess players, but you pushed this a little bit further than they did. What do you think differentiates you from them?
First of all, I was fortunate to be number 3, so I got all the plus and all the experience what my parents had with Susan and Sophia, so they could make my upbringing in a much more experienced way. So this was something very important, I believe. And also my sisters were helping me a lot. Apart from that, probably my character was the best suited for being a competitor, and I like challenges. And also somehow I was probably kind of talented, and I got great push by my success at a very early age already.
And can I ask, there is often like this strong competition between siblings, but I was wondering if this is even more so because you were all in the same field starting off with the same thing, or was this more something that put you guys even closer together because you were competing in the same teams and had like a common passion?
Yeah, this is something I was wondering myself decade or 1.5 or 2 decades ago when I started to think about it, because we were always very good friends. So when people started to ask this, I was wondering why we did not have really rivalry and any negative feelings towards each other. When, for example, I was passing Susan when I was like 13 or something. And I think the reason is because we had many difficulties during the upbringing, starting with the Hungarian Federation, as they were absolutely not supportive with the idea that my father represented that girls are able to reach the same level and they should be fighting in open section. And also we had quite big challenges from the government, because at the time it was absolutely not common that you go and you decide to have your kids homeschooled. So these two things gave so many difficulties and opposition to my parents' ideas, the way they were bringing up their children, that we were really for each other and we were extremely supportive. I like to say as a metaphor that we were like a startup company, that, you know, everybody is for one cause, and somehow whenever whoever achieved the result, whether it was Sophia in Rome or Susan with her achievements or myself, it was somehow that we all were appreciating and happy for that.
Yeah, that's very fascinating to actually manage to have that atmosphere. That's very cool. Another question that actually popped up whenever I read previous interviews with you is that you sometimes mentioned, you know, someone was invited around to your house for a few days for chess, I don't know. And I just wonder what this chess household, which is, I guess, quite untypical to most of us, look like? Is this like you had a guest room and then sometimes you hosted strong chess players and had trainings together? Or how can I imagine this?
Well, at the time, we lived in a very small apartment. It was not more than 60 square meters with a kitchen, a bathroom. There was one living room where my parents actually, it was their bedroom as well. So it was transforming during the day from the night. Then we had a room for ourselves, the three sisters. That was also where we were kind of having my training with Sophia, and in the evenings we were sleeping in that room. And then there was a third small room where it was the guest room, and also sometimes when we were training separately, we were using that for training as well. So it was a very small apartment. And indeed, there were many occasions when we had guests, trainers, chess players. And the way we had them usually when they were visiting Hungary playing in a tournament, then my parents went to the tournament looking around who is a nice person playing well. And then they went to them and they said, well, don't you want to stay for an extra few days after the tournament to play chess with my daughters? And many times people were interested and curious. And then they stayed for a few days here and there. And some of those people later on came back and became frequent visitors. So that's how it was more or less, that indeed we had not only Hungarian playing partners who were coming during the day, let's say, but also foreigners.
Good, mixing it up and having some good sparring partners. And I guess then it plays in that Hungary had such a good chess culture and so many tournaments with strong players.
Yes.
And one thing you just touched up on already, which I'd actually like to talk about, is that you mentioned that the Hungarian Federation and the World Federation at the beginning were actually not very supportive of women playing in the open section. And I guess like even nowadays, whereas that is of course totally possible, it's always a question whether there should be female only tournaments or whether they're actually a negative thing. And I was wondering what your opinion is. Of course, you're very ambitious, trying to be the best, but there's also a lot of people playing less ambitiously. So what is your opinion on having these separate women's competitions?
Well, this question I get like for a few decades already. And to tell you the truth, it's very difficult to answer properly, because I was raised completely differently from other lady chess players. And I think everybody brings their thoughts, their experiences into their forming their opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And my way was that my parents never limited me. They were always encouraging me and my sisters that we should be as good as possible in chess. Basically, this is the bottom line. And I think most of the girls have this, I'm not saying difficult, but this very classical coaching approach or parents approach, that you're a girl, so you play in the girl section. You're a girl, so we're looking for the girl champion. We want you to win the girls under 8, under 10, whatever. And the mindset itself, which defines, I think, for later results and the way you think about it. I believe that having girls' tournament and ladies' tournament, it can be quite okay even these days also for many girls and ladies. But the mindset, I would rather see that generally when I see a coach, let's say, if he or she would be saying that, well, you're talented, so why not to become the best you can? Whether after that you decide to play in the girls' tournament or in an open section, I think that's a secondary thing, you know. Because for now, I experience and I hear most of the time that when someone sees a coach, a 7-year-old talented girl or boy, they are going to approach them that, wow, you're so talented. You're going to be to a boy, they say, you can be Magnus Carlsen. If it's the girl, they say, wow, you can be women's world champion. And basically, it means that you're limiting the goals, right? Because simply in chess, you have the rating system, right? So if you become a women's world champion, you're going to be reaching 26, 50 max in rating points. If you're Magnus Carlsen, you have to be over 28, 50. So simply you put the bar on a lower level for girls. And I would be very happy if this would change. The other difficulty, of course, that many of the top elite lady players who are very talented, but they were limited by their parents, by their coaches, by the fact that they were not inspired and they didn't have the opportunity to train enough. And they also, many times when I talk to them, they say, well, Judith, you're one of a kind. That's all. We are far behind. It's impossible. And of course, I believe that if the top lady players would also say that, well, of course, if they could believe it, that, well, I didn't have those opportunities. And why not give to the little girls the opportunity? And if it will be enough for 2600 or 2500, fine. And they can decide whether they want to go for the girls' championship titles. But I think it's very important, the mindset, that if it would be mathematics or science or something else, you don't have separate girls and boys. Even though in Hungary, for example, and I think in China and maybe in other places also, sometimes they come up with new initiatives. Like in Hungary, we have an event for mathematics event for girls because it was asked by the teachers. But that's another story because it's an inspirational event that simply they want to encourage girls. It's the same thing when you talk about girls' school. So it is a very complicated question, but I believe if the society would have a different mindset and expectations from the girls, then it could change to better or to give more options in the mindset for the girls.
I think that's some really good points because we're just so shaped by our surrounding and the opinions around us. And from a very young age, they really influence our goals and everything, our self-confidence. And I guess every sport has a very strong psychological factor, right? So there's always the chess or whatever sport you do, the football, like the technical aspects. But then there's a big psychological aspect as well to do with like self-confidence, all these kind of things, what goals you have.
You know what is very strange for me, for example, and I think it's the trainers also who create that environment. It happens many times that I feel that girls have no self-confidence, where you just touch this topic, which is the most important thing, and they are shy, so they are not asking so much maybe. And many times I feel when girls are getting stronger and stronger, let's say, 2200, 2300 even, that they rely on the coach too much. If you see a boy many times of 13, most of the time they are going to be coming up with questions all the time to the coach, you know? Mm. What about this? What about this? What about this? And also when they are making preparations, for example, for a game, the boy many times will have the mindset of asking questions. I think this will be good, that will be good. And the coach can be more of a mentor, but not controlling that much all the time. And for some reason, I experienced this and I spoke with some coaches and I see it. That simply, for example, opening preparation, it happens many times that the girls rely on the coach 100%, which trust, of course, is very good. But, you know, my coach will tell me what I'm going to play. I memorize it. I understand my notes, what I have to play in the opening, and then I'm playing it. And this is also something which blocks you, I believe, that to improve in chess, you have to be extremely curious in life as well, I believe. But if the kids are curious, then that's such an inside motor in them that it's just unnoticingly you're improving. I don't know how much it's understandable what I'm trying to say about this.
Yeah, it was very clear. Can I ask you, being like, you know, such a strong player, is self-confidence something you ever had any issues with?
Well, for some time I didn't have really, because I had so many great results that people were not even be able to follow the speed I was growing in my rating points and my results. Later on, of course, when I got into the top 50, well, later on when I got to play with really the top guys, those moments, of course, when things were not going all the games so well, and I experienced how well they are prepared, and in opening they had advantage many times. Their approach of for openings, it was clearly better than mine, or that's how I felt many times with some of the really top players. And yeah, sometimes I got unbalanced regarding that, but then somehow I gained it back to healthy self-confidence. Without that, you cannot play practically. You cannot play on the same level as yourself or higher. Mm-hmm. But whatever level you are, whether you're a 2200 and you play against a 2250 average opponent, or whether you go on a higher level, doesn't matter. It's comparing to your level if you're losing your self-confidence, because it's very difficult. It's a big problem.
Liebe Podcast-Fans, mein Name ist Jonathan Karlstedt von Chessamy. Vom 4.3. bis 12.3.2023 veranstalten wir das Chessamy Open. Diesmal im 4-Sterne-Hotel Forellenhof in Walsrode. Uns würde es freuen, wenn viele von euch dort vorbeischauen würden und vielleicht sogar das Turnier mitspielen. Es gibt ein A- und ein B-Open, jeden Tag nur eine Runde, sodass man sich schön auf seine eigenen Partien konzentrieren kann. Zudem bieten wir jeden Abend ein kostenloses Seminar mit einem Chessamy-Autoren an. Wenn ihr dazu Fragen habt, könnt ihr mich unter events@chessamy.com erreichen. Und unter www.chessamy.com/open findet ihr alle wichtigen Informationen. Es haben sich schon Großmeister und internationale Meister angemeldet und wir freuen uns auf tolle 9 Tage mit euch. Vielen Dank, dass ihr mir zugehört habt, und jetzt weiterhin viel Spaß mit dieser Podcast-Folge. Tschüss!
One of the things you actually also did besides being a player is that you worked as a coach, right? So you coached the Hungarian national team, I believe. And did that give you a lot of like different views on these things, like how to deal with pressure, or like what you just said, the difference between man and woman with their coach? Or is that like a level that is so high in terms of the people you coach, they already have their coaches and their opening repertoires, and they already deal with these things by themselves, and it's more about like choosing the correct team?
Yes, when I became a captain of the Hungarian national team, to my colleagues who I was actually playing with for so many years, like Leko and Almasi and Rapport, I retired from competitive chess in 2014, and then in 2015, I was the captain for Reykjavik for the European Championship for the first time, and that followed in 2016 for the Olympiad. Those players have very much their views and ideas and the mindset towards what opening to pick. My role was much more the psychological aspect, as I knew them very well, how they behave, what bothers them, how their psychological attitude, and so on and so forth. I was like mainly focusing on that, arranging everything to make it as quiet and comfortable for them as possible. And I took the responsibility for choosing the team. And sometimes I did very strange decisions, looking it from the player's perspective. But those decisions were eventually, it was very successful. It was when we won the medal in the European Championship, because simply I was able to take off the pressure from their shoulders, which is very important, in, especially when you're playing for a medal, that you can blame all the things and everything on the captain if it's needed. And I was never tied too much to my post, so I made decisions which I simply felt the maximum point and the maximum scoring it's possible with the team. So I did not care whether in the next event I'm going to stay as a captain or not. And you know, my chess style, that's how I played also being a captain, that sometimes I was taking risky looking moves, but somehow I had the self-confidence that it works.
That's an interesting point, because it kind of implies that like the style you play chess in is also sometimes seen in your personality. And I sometimes wonder whether that's true or not, because sometimes you see, you know, like very quiet people and they have the most aggressive, beautiful attacking chess. And yeah, I always wonder if there's a correlation, but I'm not sure.
I think in many things there is, but not in everything. And it depends on the topic sometimes, because obviously, I mean, I was making moves which were looking very much suicidal. At the same time, I'm not looking forward to try out bungee jumping.
Okay, fair enough.
So it's not exactly in everything it reflects, but let's say my style and my personality, I think at the Global Chess Festival, which we organize annually, there are many things which shown there as well. And some people who visit the festival frequently and know my style, they were telling me this also. So, well, I think it reflects in many different ways, but of course not always.
Let's talk about the Global Chess Festival a bit later on. I have two more questions about your active chess career, I guess. I guess the first of my questions is there something you would consider your greatest success, like a tournament win or a game or pretty much anything?
Well, I have to tell you honestly that I had such a rich career that it's very hard to pick. Anything. If I have to pick a game, one of the most memorable one was when I won against Kasparov, of course. At the same time, that was more about the result. I had other game, for example, against Anand in 1999 in Dos Hermanas, which was from chess point of view, I remember with much bigger happiness or I look back to that as really it was such a almost a perfect game. Or even with Kasparov when I played the two draws in 2001 in Linares, with finding the right strategy with the black pieces and with the white pieces, that gave me much more satisfaction from a different angle. Events, of course, the Olympiad was quite special for the family. Even though that it was one of the very few events where I played against ladies, I was just 12 years old. And it was very important not only because we won gold medal, but also that was the first time when I met Kasparov in person. And he was watching my game, so that was extremely inspirational for me. And also that generally in Hungary, that was the moment that they were not opposing after that anymore, and we were accepted, and actually it was even appreciated the results we did. But all in all, it was the greatest thing for me that I got in the top 10 in the open category and that I was able to be challenging them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you maybe tell, so I know the story about Kasparov, but for the listeners that are not so involved with these things, why was it such a special thing, or like what was the story about the match against him and when you won the first time, why was it so big?
Well, the thing is, I think there was two points in my life clearly when the whole world was picking on this news, taking up this news. First one was when I broke Bobby Fischer's record becoming the youngest grandmaster at age of 15. That was something, a milestone that suddenly people started to say, well, maybe it's not only luck that she won the Hungarian Super Championship. Maybe it's not only luck. Maybe she's a little bit talented. So internationally and nationally, they started to look my games also. And then later on, of course, when I won against Garry Kasparov, it was actually a rapid game, not even a classical game. That was in an event where Russia played against versus the world. And this was one of the key games because practically I knocked out and Kasparov from the team, and it was completely shaky after that, and the world won. It was special for the world, I guess, that suddenly it was clear that it is possible for a woman to beat the world champion. Even if it's only one game, it's not a match of 12 games, or it's not a world championship match or whatever, but it is possible. And so that was a barrier which was broken and passed by. It was the glass ceiling I broke. And it was very symbolic, I believe, that finally it is something that the whole world knows and sees, and it's so obvious that the best female chess player beat the best player of that time and the world champion. Yeah. And of course, it was something special to me also, but for me, it was really special, those two games I just mentioned before. Because in Linares, where I played with him, it was a classical game. I knew that Garry Kasparov is in great form. I played against him on the fields where he's the best. That was my strategy, that I'm going to be like very sharpening out. So from professional aspect, that was the breaking point. That was the first move in order that I was able to crack him over the board and win against him.
Yeah. One, because you just mentioned that, you know, when you won against him, that broke a glass ceiling. And I think in chess, you broke a lot of glass ceilings by your successes and showing that we can push so much further as females. And I guess like the only ceiling you didn't break is that you didn't become the world champion. Do you think there will be a female world champion in the near future or at any point?
I don't know if it's in the near future. I think it depends very much on the ambition of any girl who is going to be playing chess. I think it's not that important, you know? Because from a chess point of view, if we would have three ladies being in the top 10, I think it would mean much more than having a world championship, world champion being a woman. Because I think the question is whether can teachers, coaches, parents, society believe that it's an option? Or it's just going to be an exception. I think it is possible. For me, it's not a question. The question is the dedication, the circumstances, the opportunity, the possibility, dedication. I don't believe at all that it matters whether you're a girl or a boy. And let's be honest, very few men are capable for that. Very few, because we had altogether how many world champions? 17? 16. So it's something very little out of the 8 billion people. So I would rather see quite a few women being in the top 50, top 30. So start balancing it out somehow. But definitely, I think the society and the mindset, which will make a turn into this direction.
Yeah. I'd like to follow up on two things you already mentioned really quickly in this interview as well. One being the Global Chess Festival, which you organized because you retired from your professional chess, but that doesn't mean you left chess behind. You're still doing all kinds of things. And the Global Chess Festival, I believe the last one you organized very recently. What kind of event is it and who is it aimed at?
Yes, it was not long time ago. It was it's always the second Saturday of October. It is an event where I want to show the diversity chess can offer to people. That basically chess is for between 4 and 120 age group. It is a festival where we want to show that chess is not happening only on the chessboard. Of course, we have chess simultaneous exhibitions and the tournament as well, and the Morgan Stanley Chess Cafe, where you can challenge the master, and we have talent measuring. And so we have these chess activities, of course. But at the same time, we want everybody to enjoy. So not everybody can enjoy what's happening on the chessboard and understand it. So we always try to make the program the way that chess is in the focus, but but it's not on the chessboard. And as we see in films, for example, in The Queen's Gambit and many others, that chess is part of the society, it's part of culture. In practically every country, I believe that it's part of it, maybe a little or more. We have very strong part where we focus on education, and we also have an educational chess conference summit, where this year is going, it was already 40 hours long, but it was also streamed. So that's very important for us that by now that we are not only offline at the Hungarian National Gallery in a very spectacular atmosphere and environment, but also that we can offer programs and talks and discussions online. And the whole festival spirit is it has a very special feeling to be there, because I think it's very inspirational. It is a very positive event where everybody's kind of happy and enjoying the different programs. In education, we had also this year programming and robotics. We had other educational element like math and chess activities. We have different platforms where kids can try out the Judith Polgár method for elementary school children and already from preschoolers, which is absolutely not the chess which is played on the chessboard, but it's even some physical exercises and different skills are built for the children. And also usually we have chess-related art, for example. In other years, we had a painter who was there during my simultaneous exhibition making a chess-related painting. We had marzipan making chess pieces out of it. So generally people can find and spend their time without being a good chess player. Even some people who don't play chess at all, they can also enjoy by watching and going around, and especially that it's in the National Gallery, of course, the paintings around, famous one. And so the idea is, how do we connect the chess being in the focus to sport, to art, to science, and of course to education.
So it's like super rich and many faceted. That's very inspirational.
We had this year more than 3,000 visitors, but before COVID, there was a year where we had the double size of two buildings. We were there, it was more than 7,000. So we have thousands of people, visitors each year.
Well, let's hope it'll get more visitors again as COVID eases and people are more keen again to travel. It probably takes some time to get back to the pre-COVID level.
Well, now we go on the online sphere, so that's where we increase the numbers, and we are also happy with that because, of course, we have a lot of foreigners who come over and want to experience. But for those who cannot travel, they have an option to be online. And this year we had an online, generally the theme was women in chess, women in science, because we wanted to connect to the FIDES year of women. And there also we had some talks and chats, picking some ladies also who were playing chess when they were teenagers. And now they are doctors and somewhere in the STEM field, they are successful. So we were trying to connect also people through chess and science, which can be interesting for the outsiders who don't play the game itself.
Yeah, so I was quite curious because I'm a biochemist myself, actually. So I was quite intrigued by the topic and was thinking, you know, what is it that makes chess and science a good combination to talk about, or why is it interesting? Because I guess there are similarities with the fields being male dominated, but that's more like the surrounding we have, but also like this logical thinking. But what do you think is the connection between science and chess?
Well, I think mainly the type of people and the mindset, they have very similar, because we need very similar skills in many ways. First of all, already you're in a very similar environment where it's very much male dominated. But also that, you have to have the perseverance in both, I believe. But also the kind of the same attitude. In chess also, you have to be scientific in some way, you have to be practical, of course, you have to be thinking ahead, taking decisions and consequences, and those fields, I think it goes very well. But mainly, I think the mindset that it is very close.
One point I want to follow up is you quickly mentioned this Judit Polgár method in education. And when I heard of this the first time, I was like, okay, it's Judit Polgár. It's probably how to become a grandmaster, you know. But I think the core is very different, and it's more about like using chess in education. Tell us a little bit more about the method and the role you think chess can play in education.
I think chess can take a big role in modern education, and I think this is recognized by many countries and in many places, and they have many different kind of great programs. The idea is, the main idea, that you have to have a systematic program, and then it works. With my method, we are developing programs for teachers who can teach those programs to kids. And the main idea is that we are using chess, the chessboard, the geometry, the coordinates. We use the chess pieces, the different pieces, values, and movements into implementing different games. We take apart the chessboard and the pieces, and we have a chess palace where we actually, the grid is on it, the 64 squares, and the kids are able to be more creative. It's a playful learning, and everything is connected one to each other. And we want those skills to be developed, which are, they are improving in their reading, they are collaborating, they make decisions, they have endless playing opportunity on the chessboard and connected to the chessboard and the pieces. And basically, it's an all-time motivational part for their learning. And this program can be integrated into their math class or language class or some whatever. And I think motivation is very important for kids, and the playfulness, because if they keep themselves curious, then they just move forward continuously. And that's very important. And through chess, we can see that they develop in a very fast way and in a healthy way. So also teachers are happy to have this frame what we offer them through the Chess Palace program for elementary school children and chess playground for the preschool children. We also have a chess PE part. That's the third leg of the method, where we use the big chess rug in physical education in their PE class.
Mm-hmm. And this method was developed by you with a team of other people with like a educational background, or how, yes, how did you come up with this? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. When my kids became in kindergarten age, then I wanted to do something, and that's how we started. I wrote together with my sister a little booklet with her drawings, and we made some rhymes and so on. And then later on, and we implemented this in the kindergarten where my kids were going. And then later on, we thought that it is possible to do something much more than just being playful on the chessboard. And then we started to work together with the teacher. We were testing, piloting with the children many of the things. We started to connect it to different subjects, what they are learning in school. We were developing with graphic designers, including my sister, but others also, to build this chess palace, which we are using in the classroom all the time. And so we were working with the teacher, also psychologist and other experts, to develop something that is very rich and very useful and beneficial for the kids growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, chess in education is such an interesting hype topic at the moment. So totally something.
Well, I think with time, it seems like the success and the positive feedback from the teachers, the kids, and at the same time from the parents, that I don't see why it should stop being so successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that within 10 years, in most of the educational institutes will include it in one way or another.
Yeah, interesting times. You just mentioned the book you wrote for when your kids got into kindergarten, which was a children's book, but you also wrote very different books because you wrote this trilogy autobiography, right?
Yes.
How was that? Because that's so different than everything you did before. I mean, it's also, I guess, chess related, but it's like writing a book seems like such a long journey and such a big effort. Was this something, and it's so different because it's like, of course it's about chess, but the main part is the writing. Was this something you enjoyed?
Well, it was a long process. I had my friend joining me and helping me out, Mikhail Marin. He's a grandmaster himself, and actually he was one of the few grandmasters also from many years ago when he visited Hungary and then visited our house and stayed, and we started to work together. It was a very long journey to make those three books because I wanted something, a great collection of my games. And I wanted something that it's memorable for me and hoping that other people can also appreciate it and learn from that the next generation. And that's why I decided to include some training games, for example, which were never published before. And I was trying to put together the trilogy the way that it's not only about my games and analysis, but more about the general view, the way I see why I became so good in chess, how I did it. I wanted to specifically talk about my early ages because I felt that most of the book of top players are about the best games, which is definitely not when you're very little, right? Because you have your best games. And I wanted to explain a little bit and show my really early age, the way I started to play chess, when I was only happy to make one move tactics and then later on three moves. So how I was growing and what environment I was growing up and what made me able and make it possible that I became so strong. And that was a very nice journey, I must say, because it's kind of looking back and summarizing your life, your career, which I never did before and ever since. And it's interesting when you look back your best games, you're selecting it, you're sorting it out, you bump into stories. I collected some stories from my diaries I was writing. And it was a very nice and enjoyable process, I must say.
That's great to hear. Yeah, I can imagine. It's like literally going back to the past and looking through all the things again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're nearly at the end, but there's a few things I still like to talk about. First of all, a lot of us nowadays know you from commentating tournaments because you do that quite a bit. Is that something you always saw yourself doing, or is that something that developed later? And what is it that you enjoy about commentating?
I was actually not thinking too much about it, whether I'm going to be a commentator or not. I remember I was happy and very excited when I was asked to be the commentator of the expert commentator in 2016 for the Karjakin-Carlsen match. And of course, at first I did not know, well, 6 hours, what are we going to talk about for one game, right? And but there were other people in the studio, there was a host, and we had some interesting things shown there. It is very interesting, of course, for a chess player to commentate, and we feel how the players are thinking because we ourselves I was there for more than 30 years being a competitor. So obviously I know many of the feeling and the psychology of the game, of the mindset of the players, or at least even if I don't know exactly what Magnus Carlsen thinks, of course, but I know the alternatives, what he can choose of, and how do they choose openings, and what is the emotional part when he's on minus one and he has to win, he has to kick back. And somehow I was enjoying sharing my experiences, how I was dealing with those situations, the psychological part, which is my favorite part in chess, as it takes a lot of part of chess. I think the higher level you go, the more it is part of it. But of course, also I was enjoying analyzing the lines and noticing maybe even faster some things when it was tactical. I showed the opportunities, the different ideas. So I was trying to explain it the way that for the audience that can be enjoyable and most understandable, and they can also learn something from it. And I felt and I feel comfortable in that role. At the same time, of course, now chess is changing very much. So now there are not my old colleagues who I'm commentating their games, but they're absolutely newcomers from different countries, but mainly right now from India, of course. So it's very interesting and fun to commentate on the chess games. And of course, you know, I mean, when you're a chess player, you're stressful because you care about the result, you have to make your preparation, how you're going to be choosing your opening and so on. But when you're a commentator, you're just talking about them. You're not losing, but you can still enjoy every bit of the game.
Yeah. So this is actually the end of our podcast. One final question we always ask to all our guests as well is, as this podcast is part of the FIDE Year of Women in Chess, which is now going to an end, what other events, ideas, in which ways would you like to see FIDE or generally women in chess supported?
Well, there are a lot of different ways I think it can be supported and it should be supported. First of all, I think from every way. I think, of course, it's great when they have better prize fund for women competitions. I think there should be or could be some seminars for teachers, for parents, for mindset questions. Appreciating women in chess, not only as a professionals, as being a professional chess players, but also being around in other roles. It's very important. And somehow make events which is inspiring for girls to become a chess player. Whether you're on a lower level or higher level, that's, I think, in the beginning, it does not matter at all. But to create an environment where girls can feel comfortable between boys, between men, creating a safe environment. And unfortunately, I hear here and there not very pleasant stories, the comments, what ladies get and receive. So I think those things has to be taken very seriously by the International Federation and everywhere, that really creating a very safe, pleasant and entertaining, good environment where girls feel safe to be playing or chatting or just being there. And also it's important to acknowledge the results of girls and women. So I was kind of happy that FIDE created the awards for women, because I think that means a lot for ladies, and it is very encouraging for them that it's worth doing something and it is recognized. So I think that there should be different occasions when just at least a little bit talk about the ladies' aspect and to inspire girls. And I think men also should be inspiring girls. It's not only women role models who should be there. But I think men who believe, at least on certain degree, that girls can also become grandmasters and even 2700, they should be expressing this. So there should be creating those platforms or showing, for example, best games of ladies, because there are a lot of exceptionally good and nice games from Kosteniuk, from my sister Susan, from many, many girls, Anna Mozichuk. I can say plenty of ladies, Xi Jun, Hui Fan. I mean, all those ladies, they have really exceptional good games. And I can tell you that if those games are published and shown, nobody would tell them that it's a ladies' game. It's just a good game.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Judith, for being our guest today. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. And thank you so much for your input and your stories and everything.
Thank you very much.